Welcome to the Sunshine Economy. Today it's License to Launder, Cash Cops and Cartels. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. Millions of dollars flow through the South Florida economy every day. Most of those dollars are legitimate. They're clean. But some of those dollars are dirty. By virtue of our geography and history, South Florida is a magnet for bad money. From healthcare fraud to drug cartels. This week, our partner, the Miami Herald, examines a local law enforcement money laundering investigation effort that stretched from South Florida across the country. It touched millions of tainted dollars, but disbanded with lots of unanswered questions. We'll start with WLRN's Kenny Malone. He explains the Miami Herald's findings and the story of an unlikely money laundering task force from two small police departments.
Sometime after World War II, planners for a tiny community north of Miami Beach decided they needed a better name. Their village was on both Biscayne Bay and the Atlantic Ocean. The Bay, the Atlantic, Bay Atlantic, Bellantic. It takes a little work to get there, but that is how the village of Bay Harbor became the village of Bal Harbor. True story.
Well, we gotta wait a minute.
It's about 4 o'clock on a Monday. Brian Mulheron stands on the corner of Collins Avenue across the street from the Bal Harbor shops. He presses the crossing signal button.
Do you think these things even work?
It does work.
Really?
Mulheron knows this, it turns out, because some of the Bal Harbor residents were having trouble making it across Collins Avenue in time. So he and the Citizens Coalition he helped found got more crossing time added.
But you gotta push the button.
Our crossing light turns green.
You got 29 seconds to get across.
The Bal Harbor shops, Prada and Chanel, Gucci and Armani, is pound for pound the most profitable mall in the country, according to Fortune magazine. It's not even close. And the median price of a home or condo in the zip code centered around Bal Harbor, just shy of $600,000 in January. That's according to RealtyTrack. And so it's possible to forget that Bal Harbor is more than just a fancy place on the Baylantic waterfront. It's also a small town with crosswalk problems and citizens groups and full-time residents like Brian Mulheron who care a lot about things like walkability.
I don't play golf. I don't play tennis. I walk.
Mulheron says he walks 7 to 10 miles a day. In fact, he's wearing his walking uniform, a wide-brimmed Notre Dame hat, white polo shirt, off-white shorts, white Velcro sneakers.
White clothing, and it also protects you from mosquitoes. White keeps them away.
Mulheron's a retired New York City detective. He's 67 years old, never married, no kids. He still keeps his detective's badge in his pocket. After a bad car crash in New York, Mulheron stopped driving and eventually retired to Bal Harbor. About 2,500 people live in the village. And walking with Brian Mulheron.
Hello, Roberta. Hello, David. How you doing, Mark?
Hey, Brian.
Seems like he knows all of them.
You know, when you walk and you pay attention, you see a lot of things going on in this village. I look, I watch, and I know everything that's going on. And if I see something out of the ordinary, I know it.
Mulheron is taking me to perhaps the epitome of what out of the ordinary can look like in Bal Harbor. Around the corner from the Bal Harbor shops, past the old church by the sea,
elegant with the steeple,
we duck into a municipal parking lot and walk up to a patch of well-manicured grass.
So this is the spot, huh?
Well, the trailer was right where these date palm trees are. It was right in here.
If you come to this spot a few years ago, there would have been a trailer, the kind you see outside of a construction site or a school that needs to add an extra classroom in a pinch. It was beige with a light green awning.
A handicap entrance. Was
a ramp up to the door, some windows.
You couldn't see in.
Because there were blinds on the windows.
You were, you know, covered or whatever.
Brian Mulheron's one of a handful of people you'll hear from today who sometimes metaphorically, sometimes literally, were on the outside looking in, trying to piece together exactly what was going on inside that beige trailer. And piece by piece, a story is now emerging. From Mulheron's perspective, standing in this very spot, he couldn't see in, but he said he'd see police officers coming and going. And as the president of the Citizens Coalition, as a guy who's not shy about requesting public records or going to village council meetings, Mulheron did have some idea what was going on. And then in 2011, he saw a document.
We're going to the mission statement.
A memorandum of understanding, it's called, that confirmed what he'd been hearing.
Okay.
It says the task force is a multi-agency money laundering narcotics task force with participation by local agencies and assisted by federal and state entities targeting major money laundering organizations within Florida and the United States. The primary focus of the task force is money laundering.
A money laundering task force from the village of Bal Harbor.
Well, we're, again, a small village with a small police department. We don't have drug problems or money laundering problems in Bal Harbor. So why would we go into basically what they were doing as a business? and they were only going to do money laundering at a scale that was outrageous, and it just didn't fit in.
A new Miami Herald investigation is pulling back the curtain on the money laundering task force that was running from that small beige trailer. And while the trailer may be gone, there are lingering questions, important questions, about whether the work that took place inside that trailer helped take dirty money off the streets and catch criminals, or just enrich the department and finance luxury living by the police. Did the money laundering task force simply launder money for criminals it was supposed to catch?
Come in.
Hi, Christina.
For the last 9 months, my colleague from the Miami Herald, Michael Sala, has been making trip after trip after trip to a small office just yards, actually, from where that beige trailer used to be. He and a fellow reporter were given exclusive access to thousands of records, including undercover operation reports, wire transfers, DEA documents, and bank statements from what became known as the Tri-County Task Force.
Here's all the money that's going into SunTrust. There are 7 accounts. They're all under dummy corporate names.
Throughout this story, you'll hear there are details from these files we can't reveal. There are a lot of people involved in a money laundering cycle, many of whom would have had no idea they were actually doing business with the Belle Harbor police. A simple example, these bank accounts for fake businesses. The task force used them to look like money launderers, so giving the real names of these fake companies could cause problems.
Their names, like if you said Advent Technology LLC. You know, that's a typical undercover money laundering name that they would adopt for all these different accounts.
That's not one of them, to be clear.
No, it's not, but it's that kind of a generic.
The findings from this 9-month-long investigation are in the Miami Herald this week. It's an investigation that took Mike from this tiny room next to the fancy Belle Harbor shops to here.
That was the sugar train. We went through the heart of Glades County.
The Glades County Sheriff's Office is surrounded by sugarcane fields and cow pastures. Chief Deputy Dwayne Podorf jokes that there are more cows in this county than people. And the kinds of crime here?
It's minor crime. Knock on wood. You know, maybe every 2 years we'll get a murder. You know, some years we've had 4, some years we've had none. But, you know, maybe every other year we'll get one murder.
Around 2009, the Belle Harbor Police Department met with Glades County about launching their own money laundering task force. For Belle Harbor, having a sheriff's office involved would help the operation deputize a couple former cops in New York to help stretch the reach of the sting operation outside of Florida. For Glades County, Podorf says, for a small sheriff's office like his, these task forces are a huge help. They let him share resources and build relationships with agencies that have different experience and might be able to help out down the line. Plus, with a money laundering sting, there's the money.
The reason we got started was we're a small rural county. So the more ad valorem taxes go down because everybody wants to give everybody a break on their taxes, the less money's coming in for revenue to be used for budgets. And everybody's budget was being cut year after year after year. So we had to find other revenue streams, and the good way for revenue is through task force and forfeitures.
Asset forfeitures. If a money laundering sting leads to the seizure of cash, federal authorities can let the agencies who helped make that seizure share in the money and use it to supplement some parts of their policing budget.
I could buy the cars that I need, the guns that I need, the bulletproof vests that I need for the deputies, and I can send the deputies to the education and the training that they needed. The community gets a better trained and prepared deputy to answer their calls for service and investigate their crime.
This is not the place, I must say, that people would have expected to be a partner in an international money laundering investigation.
This is the Miami Herald's Mike Sala interviewing Chief Deputy Podorf.
Did you have some hesitation about that, or did you have any concerns when you went into it?
Once we knew that we were going to partner with Belle Harbor, and I think we felt very, very confident about it.
Because of their experience.
Correct.
That experience stemmed from Belle Harbor's chief of police at the time.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Chief Tom Hunker of the Belle Harbor Police Department.
Hunker declined a recorded interview for the Miami Herald series and didn't return WLRN's calls requesting an interview. But we do have these not-so-great recordings from a 2012 Belle Harbor Village Council meeting. Hunker explained to the council why a village of 2,500 with about 24 police officers was running a money laundering task force. Hunker had fairly extensive experience running undercover money laundering stings, and as a result, he still had confidential informants around the country. He explained that those informants have information, and Belle Harbor has an obligation to do something with that information.
If someone would come to the Bell Harbor Police Department and tell us that there's a murder suspect in New York City for a murder that was committed here, what would we do? We would call that local police department and tell them, this is what the case is, this is who did it, go get them. Well, that's exactly what we're doing here, folks. People say that this is all about the money. And anybody that's known me, and over almost 40 years I've been a cop, it's not about the money with me.
Tom Hunker resigned after the Department of Justice investigated how Bell Harbor was spending forfeiture money to pay salaries. There are rules about what departments can and can't use forfeitures to pay for. But that Department of Justice investigation, it turned out, had only just scratched the surface of what was going on with the Tri-County Task Force.
WLRN's Kenny Malone. Still to come, how the modern money laundering cycle works and the troubled trail left by the police task force.
You've now created a situation where you've put bad money into the system, illicit proceeds into the system, and you've taken out in the form of proceeds from the sale of computer equipment, electronics, and given it the appearance that, you know, the money's good.
And they laundered around $55.6 million in less than 3 years. And they essentially returned it to the cartel, laundered, cleaned, and ready to go.
Welcome back to the Sunshine Economy here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. Today we're examining money laundering in South Florida. Our news partners at the Miami Herald have a new investigation out this week. It's called License to Launder, Cash, Cops, and Cartels. It details one of Florida's largest undercover money laundering task forces and the thin line between posing as a money launderer and actually functioning as one. WLRN's Kenny Malone continues our report explaining the Herald's findings and money laundering in South Florida.
In case there's any confusion about this at all, there is no washing machine with money laundering. But it's not a bad analogy. It's called money laundering after all. Imagine you're the head of a Latin American drug cartel. You sell kilos upon kilos of drugs in the United States. That earns thousands upon thousands of dollars in cash. Dirty cash. And there's the fundamental problem that spending that kind of dirty drug cash, pretty hard.
Well, sure. I mean, if you want to buy a house, certainly some eyebrows would be raised if you just showed up with a bag full of cash.
This is Ivan Garces. He's a principal at Kaufman Rossen. Kaufman Rossen is a regular underwriter for WLRN and, in fact, an underwriter of this show. But we asked Michael Sala, the Miami Herald's lead reporter on their new investigation, to point us towards someone who knows their money laundering, and Garces does. He's a certified public accountant, fraud examiner, and anti-money laundering specialist.
Money laundering is essentially making illicit proceeds look clean. That's basically the process.
So again, you're the head of a drug cartel in Latin America. You've got your piles of dirty U.S. cash. That's a money counter, by the way. Your goal is to wash away that money's dirty history, get the clean cash from the U.S. to your home country, get it converted into your home currency, and live like a drug kingpin. How do you do this?
It's through a process that's widely known as trade-based money laundering.
It's a fairly complicated process, but simple goal. Drug cash in the United States, cleaned, converted, and repatriated to your home country. So let's start in your home country. Imagine there's an electronics retail store in your hometown, the kind a normal person would go into to buy a stereo or MP3 player or a computer. One day that store is running low on laptops. Instead of just ordering them on their own, enter the money launderer. Technically, there could be a money launderer plus a money broker plus a money courier, but for simplicity's sake, let's just say money launderer. He takes all this drug money in the United States and finds an electronics exporter, maybe in Miami.
So somebody will come into the store in Miami, buy $1,000, $20,000, $50,000 worth of electronics.
Now your drug cash has essentially become computers. Those computers are, at some point, shipped to that retail store in your home country. Again, that retail store actually wants to sell those laptops to customers.
That product will then be sold in the local currency and provided back to the narcotics trafficker, the drug dealer, the, you know, person behind the scheme.
In other words, the computers are converted into your hometown currency. That is laundered money. To recap, drug cash buys bulk computers in U.S., shipped to Latin American retail store, and sold. Trade-based money laundering. The launderer hasn't just moved the cash from the U.S. to Latin America. He's added layers of complexity and ambiguity by involving businesses. Plus, those stacks and stacks of illicit U.S. dollars come out the other end of the laundering cycle in a different currency, which is to say, whatever currency you, the kingpin, want.
So you've now created a situation where you've put bad money into the system, illicit proceeds into the system, and you've taken out in the form of proceeds from the sale of computer equipment, electronics, and given it the appearance that, you know, the money's good.
In theory, the person buying the computer has no idea that, like, the purchase order was made in drug money.
And very similarly, the electronics company in Miami may not know as well what the nature of the activity is. You know, they may just be thinking they're making a sale of computers. So they may unwittingly be used in some of these schemes.
For about 3 years, millions of dollars in trade-based money laundering ran right through that beige trailer near the Bal Harbour shops. The Tri-County Task Force posed as money launderers, getting drug cash in the U.S. to those exporters in the U.S. But before they could do that, they had to go undercover and pick up the dirty cash from criminal organizations. And that part of the process reads like it is straight out of Hollywood. We should start in Queens, maybe, yeah?
Sure. Well, you know, Queens, in a small, quiet neighborhood, very leafy neighborhood back in 2010.
Again, Miami Herald investigative reporter Mike Sala. And we have to be sort of vague about the location to protect any confidential informants. But we're in a leafy neighborhood in Queens. May have sounded something like this. It's almost summer. It's unseasonably hot, broad daylight near the street.
And a car pulls up, pulls by the side of the road, waits. The driver's looking out the window. And coming down the street is a woman pushing a baby stroller.
The woman walks closer and closer within an arm's length of the car and stops the baby stroller.
She reaches in where typically a baby would be, and she pulls out a black backpack and then hands it to the man in the car. And as quickly as she hands it to him, he speeds away.
In that backpack, a pile of cash.
$152,740.
The cash heads for a plane, is flown to South Florida, and ultimately dumped out onto a table inside that beige trailer.
In the shadows of the very exclusive Bal Harbour shops. And in this trailer, which is unmarked, they will then pull out the money, count it, photograph it. They will then bundle it and drive it across the street to the SunTrust Bank.
Where the task force had set up a series of accounts with dummy company names, the ones we can't say. From there, the task force was told where to wire the money, often to Miami exporters, and the trade-based money laundering cycle begins. The task force was posing and functioning as the money launderer in that trade-based money laundering cycle. The task force took a cut of the money they helped clean. In theory, this would help keep up appearances because, you know, real money launderers aren't doing charity work. The leafy Queens neighborhood, the baby stroller, the $152,740, the Miami Herald found that the task force took part in hundreds of these kinds of pickup drop-off exchanges. Undercover officers would head all over the country.
Chicago, Houston, Los Angeles, San Juan, Boston.
Where money couriers would secretly hand off whatever they were carrying cash in.
A blender box, a Gucci gift box, a tortilla box, a Chicago Bears t-shirt.
Each of those would be taken to that beige trailer in Bal Harbour and get dumped out onto a table.
$20,000, $50,000, $100,000, $200,000.
And counted.
$300,000, $460,000, $500,000, $600,000, $799,000, $1.361 million.
Over the course of 3 years, the task force helped launder 235 backpacks or Gucci bags or tortilla boxes or whatever full of cash.
And they laundered around $55.6 million in less than 3 years. And they essentially returned it to the cartel, laundered, cleaned, and ready to go.
From that tiny trailer behind the Bal Harbour shops, the Tri-County Task Force was running one of Florida's largest undercover money laundering sting operations in years. It appeared Bal Harbour's chief of police, Tom Hunker, had helped set up an ambitious operation that had infiltrated major money laundering operations, some of which were working for violent international criminal organizations.
Most of your federal agencies have what they call a kingpin mentality.
Again, Bal Harbour's former chief of police, Tom Hunker, speaking to the Village Council in 2012.
They want to go after the people in Colombia. I don't have that mentality. I want to go after the drug dealers that are here and take them off the street and take the profit out of it. And that's why I got involved in this task force.
After Hunker was done speaking at that meeting, the village council opened up the floor to the public.
I do see a hand raised. Brian?
Brian Mulheron, the retired New York City detective and president of the Bal Harbor Citizens Coalition, the guy who couldn't see inside that beige trailer behind the Bal Harbor shops, but didn't like the idea of the village running a money laundering task force. He takes the mic and presents his objections, rather passionately.
What is the Bal Harbor Police Department operating a task force with the sheriff of Glades County?
Mulheron tells the council that he wants to see more transparency with the task force, that he'd like to see it investigated, and that it's a questionable use of resources. He goes on like this for 3 minutes, to be precise.
And this village needs a forensic audit. Excuse me? Well, the clock isn't working.
There was a 3-minute time limit, which Mulheron goes over to say,
we need to know and we need to see what's going on.
Mulheron now says that one of the reasons he was suspicious of the task force was because some of the same officers he'd seen coming and going from that beige trailer, he'd also see out on the waterfront smoking cigars or in fancy hotels.
In the Bal Harbor shops, in the restaurants eating, in Capaccio's all the time.
He says it didn't seem to him like much police work was happening.
You know, I mean, we had no control.
100 miles away, at the Glades County Sheriff's Office, Chief Deputy Dwayne Podorf says he had virtually no control over the operation and no idea what was really going on. For example, the task force was using an American Express card that had been set up in the Glades County name. And while the task force was paying off that bill on their own, Podorf wanted the receipts for his own records. So he called and he asked for them.
They're coming, we'll get them. You know, they had 100 excuses of why we didn't get them. We weren't getting any cooperation trying to get the receipts.
There may simply have been no receipts to give. The Miami Herald was granted unprecedented access to the task force's records and found a Pandora's box of problems, missing reports, unexplained cash withdrawals, questionable expenses, and a near total lack of receipts that might help give answers about those questionable expenses. What lead reporter Mike Sala was able to piece together was that the task force had earned nearly $2 million in money laundering fees. And while experts say that money should have been treated as evidence, the task force was using it for first-class flights, luxury car rentals, fancy hotels, and fancy dinners.
We found $400 dinners at Carpaccio's, and we found a $450 dinner at the Chop House in Chicago. We found a $1,000 dinner at the Bal Harbor 101 restaurant. We found a $1,000 dinner at the Morton's in North Miami Beach. For a unit that was very specifically looking for signs of financial crime, they didn't spare any expenses in their own spending.
Maybe most troubling is that the Herald's investigation found that the Tri-County Task Force, one of the largest Florida money laundering task forces in years, couldn't account for a single arrest on its own. The task force claimed that it passed on tips to federal agents, which led to around 200 arrests. The DEA says some arrests were made, but the agency was skeptical of the 200 number.
Think about it this way. You're committing a crime to detect a crime. So you have to document that. You're given a license to launder. You're giving a open envelope to basically launder money and commit a crime. You have to have something to show for that.
I cannot explain or make excuses for how Bar Harbor did their task force. It's out of my control.
Chief Deputy Dwayne Podorf of the Glades County Sheriff's Office now admits that being a part of the Tri-County Task Force is a black eye for his office. It's the kind of thing he has to explain to residents when he's out in public.
You know, how did this happen? You know, why were we with Bal Harbor? You know, same thing I'm sure people in Bal Harbor say is, where's Glades County? People here say, where's Bal Harbor? And we go back to how this happened, you know, and how we got started.
It's a question Bal Harbor is dealing with, too. How and why did this get started? The village has a new chief of police and city manager who are looking into the task force.
What do you think at this point?
The Miami Herald's Mike Sala interviewing Bal Harbor's new city manager, George Gonzalez.
Are you in a position where you could draw a conclusion on what the whole purpose? Was it all just about the money? Was it policing for profit?
That's going to be speculating. I would say this, in a village of the type of Bal Harbor, the size and scope and clientele, I would wonder why we would ever entertain doing something like this.
We're passing the village hall.
Brian Mulheron, the retired New York City detective and walking enthusiast.
Into the parking lot where the public works.
As he stands where that beige trailer used to be, he says he never felt good about what was happening in there.
But I didn't realize the amount of money that was involved. When I found that out, and now I've found out much more, it's unbelievable for a village of Bal Harbor Police Department to be doing what they were doing. They were running a business, a money laundering business. They didn't make any arrest. They didn't prosecute anybody. They didn't go after the bad guy. They didn't do anything.
Well, Heron says that, in essence, the task force wound up being money launderers for criminal organizations.
They facilitated and allowed these organizations to make money and move money all over the country, all over the world. That's what they were doing.
The Tri-County Task Force disbanded in 2012. The following year, Tom Hunker resigned under pressure as chief of Bell Harbor Police. Under its new chief and new city manager, the village launched an audit of the task force's finances last year. Preliminary numbers show that the undercover operation may have laundered $28 million more than the $55 million the Herald's investigation found, and that there may be hundreds of thousands of dollars unaccounted for from cash withdrawals. Former police chief Tom Hunker told the Miami Herald that in the end, the audit won't find anything wrong. Bell Harbor officials won't comment until the inquiry is complete. As for any wrongdoing, they say that is for the feds to decide. Bell Harbor's already handed over preliminary results of their audit to the FBI, but officials say it may be a long time before they track down all of the millions of dollars hauled to that beige trailer behind the Bell Harbor shops. I'm Kenny Malone in Miami.
Still to come on our program, the special focus on Doral in the hunt for dirty money. Welcome back to the Sunshine Economy, License to Launder, Cash Cops, and Cartels. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. For 8 months, the Miami Herald looked at confidential files of the Tri-County Task Force made up of sheriffs from rural Glade County and cops from Bell Harbor. According to the task force's mission statement, it was designed to, quote, significantly diminish the capacity of money laundering organizations operating within targeted areas. Now, the group handled tens of millions of dollars in dirty money over the course of almost 3 years, some of it delivered to electronics businesses in Doral. Mike Sala is the reporter for the Miami Herald behind the investigation with us again here on the Sunshine Economy. Mike, what action did this task force take with the companies in Doral?
We found no evidence at all of any actions whatsoever. Of the $55.6 million that they laundered, there are about $20 million went through the exporters in Doral. We found no evidence of any eavesdropping, none whatsoever of any warrants. There were no arrests. There were no civil actions.
This was one area in Doral that was highly concentrated in terms of receiving these dollars that Bell Harbor and the Tri-County Task Force was responsible for uncovering and finding. In April, the U.S. Treasury Department's Financial Crimes Enforcement Network Bureau put an action in Doral called the Geographic Targeting Order. Five zip codes were identified in and around Doral. It requires electronics exporters to report any cash transaction over $3,000. Usually that threshold is 10 grand, so it significantly lowered that threshold. Now, the Assistant Special Agent in charge at Homeland Security Investigations of U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement is John Toban, and John joins us here as well. John, your agency helped put in place this so-called GTO, the Geographic Targeting Order. Why in these five zip codes?
We have been involved in investigating trade-based money laundering for a long, long time. And what we did is we did a review of, you know, what is going on? What have we found in all of these years? And we saw that geographic concentration of targets, wire transfer recipients, both from, from all sorts of different places. And certainly it wasn't a very well-kept secret. I mean, this was probably the worst kept secret in terms of money laundering in South Florida for, you know, since, you know, the late 80s.
Did any of the work from this Tri-County Task Force from Bell Harbor and Glades County lead to this geographic targeting order that your agency helped put in place in April?
We did not have access to their files or their records. This was all the old information came from us and from the South Florida Money Laundering Strike Force, which is led by the state attorney's office.
So what's been the effect since April?
We've seen the effect in a couple of different ways. We have identified a couple of ways in which individuals involved in the black market vessel have tried to go around it. Obviously, we are limited because the BSA is limited to cash transactions. So we can only put limits on the amount of cash being transacted.
And when we're talking about cash here, it's important. We're also talking about cold hard currency in U.S. dollars, but really any international currency, but also money orders, cashier's checks, treasury checks, those types of things. So it's not just a bag full of money necessarily.
Right. It's money orders. It's delivering a third party cashier's check. An individual off the street walks into the business and say, hey, by the way, here's $2,000, and please apply these $2,000 or these $10,000 or these $20,000 to invoice 123 for ABC importers.
Has the geographic targeting order led to any charges or arrests yet?
Not yet. It has only
any new investigations opened up?
Lots of new investigations, yes.
700 businesses were identified in this release from the Treasury Department, this geographic targeting order, but they wouldn't share any of those business names publicly. And in fact, when I contacted FinCEN, the Treasury Department's agency bureau here responsible, and asked them to confirm whether or not certain businesses were even involved here, they wouldn't confirm that either. Why such secrecy?
It's not necessarily secrecy. It's the companies may be witting or unwitting participants. We realize that. We do not want to stigmatize these companies to say they are, that every single one of them knows the extent of what's happening. I think there is a great misunderstanding for how alternative gray, black, blue currency markets work. And a lot of them receive some pretty reasonable sounding justifications as to why their customers utilize this method for payment. So that's part of the reason we want to make sure that, we will investigate the companies that we know, that we see information that they are willing participating, and we aim to educate the rest of the companies who are unwitting participants in the system.
Mike Sala with the Miami Herald investigative reporter. Protect the innocent, I think, is kind of what John perhaps is saying here. But it does provide the difficulty of not being able to know what the companies that are perhaps knowingly involved with this black market peso, this money laundering scheme.
That's a really good point that John makes. I think that there are distinctions. What we found in tracing all of the bank wires that the undercover officers were sending to, and please understand, when the officers would fly off, they would pick up large amounts of drug cash. They would bring it back, and then they would wire it to various companies to be able to launder. We weren't as much concerned with companies that took two or three wires. But when you start to see companies take two dozen wires for almost $1 million from third party, remember the police were setting up shell companies. These aren't customers that these businesses were doing business with. So those were the red flags. That's where you can start to look at the areas of what I would call the red zone. And John may have another word for it. But it's those are the companies, and there were lots of them in that area, that were taking in large amounts of wires for a lot of money, sometimes three wires in a single day.
We've got more to come here on the Sunshine Economy. Stick with us. We're going to talk about money laundering then and now, with a former money launderer who spent time in federal prison and now works with law enforcement and banks identifying dirty money. That's still to come on the Sunshine Economy. We're back on the Sunshine Economy here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. We're looking at money laundering here in South Florida. A new Miami Herald investigation critically examines a police task force based in Bell Harbor that spent almost 3 years working undercover. It did hundreds of deals and handled millions of dollars, but could not account for a single arrest on its own. Kent Rejock is from South Florida, lives in Key Biscayne, spent 19 months in prison for laundering tens of millions of dollars back in the 1980s. Can you now work with law enforcement and with banks identifying people doing what you did back in the 1980s? You wrote a book about your experiences called The Laundryman. How has money laundering changed from your days of bags of cash through airports to now perhaps bags of cash through electronics exporters, for instance, in Doral?
Well, unfortunately, it's much more advanced due to the internet, due to more international commerce from Miami-Dade County, and also because of the fact that the black market peso exchange has changed. Back in the 1980s, if you were a Colombian drug trafficker and you needed to make profits in local pesos, you would work through Miami or through some other part of the United States where they would get money to the Panamanian free trade zone in dollars for Colombians who needed dollars to buy things but didn't have dollars. They only had pesos. The pesos would end up in the hands of the drug traffickers who would build an apartment building in Medellin. Now it's so much more streamlined because now if a drug trafficker wants a client of his, a legitimate client who needs electronics, well, let's give him the money here in Dade County. Let him ship us all the electronics, and I'll give you my pesos down there in Caracas or in Bogota or wherever you're located. And it's seamless now.
There's less friction.
That's right, and less chance for discovery and for interdiction.
How did you elude law enforcement in the 1980s?
Well, I didn't keep records, and I worked outside the banking system in the United States. And bulk cash smuggling, which is where all of it started with me, is a very crude and effective means of evading the banking system by smuggling the cash out of the United States into the offshore banking centers who deliberately don't keep records for U.S. law enforcement.
When you hear stories such as this Tri-County Task Force based out of Bal Harbor focused on money laundering, significant impact in certain areas, what does occur to you regarding their law enforcement activities and their efforts toward money laundering?
Well, if law enforcement seizes the proceeds of crime, if they seize the money, then they have taken the incentive out of the drug traffickers and individuals in Latin America who will only survive if they get those illicit profits. So when a law enforcement agency in a comprehensive program actually seizes the cash en route, they knock the stuffing out of the traffickers. It works.
Mike Sala, the investigative reporter for the Miami Herald, did that happen in this case with the Bal Harbor task force seizing $55 million of dirty money?
The analysis says no. They actually laundered far more money. There is what they call a ratio. Task forces are ever mindful of we have to seize more than we're laundering. So you launder a dollar so that maybe down the road you seize $3 and you make it worth your while to break the law. In this case, in a two-year period, they laundered $50 million. The tips they passed on to the DEA at best led to about $30 million in seizures, which meant that they were laundering far more money than they were seizing. Now, if you also look at the money, they were also, we believe, according to information coming out of an audit, that they didn't report another $28 million that they laundered. Their laundering was up to $83 million. And that's money they're actually returning to the cartels mm-hmm. and other drug organizations. That's not the kind of ratio you want. You're basically a money launderer at that point.
John Toban, as Assistant Special Agent in charge at Homeland Security Investigations for ICE, focused on financial crimes, focused on money laundering here. Your reaction to Mike's reporting in the Bal Harbor Strike Force?
I think that the reporting was surprising, actually, in the amount of access Mike was able to get and the documents. Certainly troubling, and I think you know it was echoed by my colleagues that Mike spoke to, that it was done, and there seems to be such a lack of oversight.
Are incentives when it comes to money laundering investigations, to Ken's point and to Mike's point regarding seizures and ratios, are they misaligned for law enforcement when it comes to money laundering?
I wouldn't say necessarily misaligned, but it is. A symptom, I guess, of just government management at all levels, that if you are able to get funding from another source that is not coming from your home agency or from your home department, then they say, okay, you need less, and your budget would get cut. So in some instances, yes, we see that success will lead to the responsible overseer of that agency saying, okay, you know what? You have too much money. We will cut your funds because now you have those funds.
And what's as you go through a budgetary process for your office, how are those kind of seizures or potential seizures dealt with?
At the federal level, it doesn't affect us. It doesn't affect my funding. All of our seized money goes into a Treasury forfeiture fund. And that process is completely separate and apart from our funding. So there is no incentive at the federal level. I mean, we do it because it's the right thing to do. But we look at it as a crime prevention, crime reduction, rather than the profit.
Ken Rejack, you work with law enforcement now after spending time for racketeering was the official charge for you. Is that right? Not money laundering. It
That's
was racketeering.
Correct.
Yeah. And how is law enforcement and the agencies you consult with and lecture engaged with money laundering? And how is it different here in South Florida, perhaps, compared to other agencies?
Well, in my opinion, in my experience, they're extremely effective. The problem with South Florida is that it's understaffed and undermanned and underfunded. You know, you can go into a law enforcement agency and see a bunch of empty desks and realize they need a hell of a lot more people than they actually have. And they need people who are cross-trained, not just people who have gone from working in a local sheriff's office to working for a federal agency, but who actually have financial crime training, who may have worked in a private business for a while and they have that perspective.
And Mike Sala with the Miami Herald, part of the rationale behind this Tri-County Task Force was not only the law enforcement experience of the law of the police chief at the time, but also the ability to go in, disrupt the drug trade, disrupt money laundering, and there was a financial incentive at the end of the day as well.
Yeah, they ended up charging commissions, which you can do. If you're posing as a money launderer, you are going to charge the money broker or the drug organizations a certain percentage of the money. So they did, and we haven't begun to see how much they actually brought in. We believe it was a minimum of $1.7 million was their incentive, and then they turned around and used that to fund the operation. I think the troubling aspect of it, again, is the amount of money that was laundered vis-a-vis what was seized. Mm-hmm. You always want to seize a lot more money and take off the streets than what you actually launder and return back to the bad guys.
We will continue here with our special License to Launder, Cash, Cops, and Cartels here on the Sunshine Economy. Coming up next, fighting the legacy of dirty money here in South Florida. And we're back here on WLRN, the Sunshine Economy, License to Launder, Cash, Cops, and Cartels. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. South Florida is a magnet for dirty money. By one measure, banks here file the fourth most reports regarding suspicious money activity in the United States, behind New York, Los Angeles, and Houston. Now, these reports capture only the money flowing in and out of banks, financial institutions, not other avenues that dirty money has to get into the economy and the South Florida economy. We're here with Mike Sala, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter with the Miami Herald, behind the series License to Launder. Mike, what's the impact that this kind of money laundering activity has on South Florida?
Well, I think there is an entire industry that has come to almost depend on it, at least to some extent. I believe that there are a lot of obviously very honest and hardworking exporters, but there are those that actually rely on this for their income stream. And I think that they're not large operations, a lot of them. And so the amount of money that can come in through the black market peso exchange actually helps them pay their bills and keep their operation going.
John Toban, Assistant Special Agent in Charge at Homeland Security and ICE, looked at money laundering here. Do you agree with that?
Yes.
Yeah?
I think it's a very good assessment.
And what's the impact on the broader South Florida economy, reputation and otherwise?
Well, I mean, it clearly weakens the standing of the financial system. And I think if you look at what happened, just with the recent, the recent banking issues that we had, it really is, we are, as a world, we're tied by our financial system. And lack of confidence in one world's financial system reverberates throughout the system.
John, you've made a career in law enforcement, made a career in money laundering and anti-money laundering endeavors, and you've worked in the Southern District of New York, again, one of the top places of money laundering investigations. What can South Florida learn from the Southern District of New York and perhaps vice versa in terms of attacking the issue?
Well, both in the Southern District and in the Eastern District of New York, I mean, there are specialized units that focused on money laundering.
Within the prosecutor's office.
Within the prosecutor's office. Yeah. I mean, and part of that is because, look, there's Wall Street. There's all of this money, all of these ways, all of these avenues to launder money that have nothing to do with narcotics. And I think, if anything, and I've only been here for a little bit over 2 years, and one of the things that I've been preaching with my colleagues is to say, look, we need to, you know, we need to realize that South Florida is no longer the trafficking hub that it used to be. That has moved.
Trafficking in terms of?
In terms of narcotics. Mm. This is not where they warehouse the narcotics anymore the way they used to. But this is where all the money still gets laundered. And if you look at the size of our financial system here, it really, you know, it really creates a huge vulnerability.
Ken Rejack, you were part of that money laundering industry back in the 1980s. Your response to John's assessment of here in the 21st century?
Well, the problem appears to be that non-banking companies, such as exporters, who really need to have their own anti-money laundering compliance program, are not required by law to do so. So if they don't have a compliance officer at ABC Exporters, he's not going to realize and tell the management, wait a minute, there's something wrong with these transactions. It's a third-party transaction. We haven't identified the remitter. What we need is we need to broaden the law so that not just banks and money service businesses actually have a compliance department, but any non-bank but still handles financial transactions also is required to have one.
But you'll hear the two-person family exporter in Doral saying the cost of compliance would put me out of business.
But they can outsource it. There are plenty of competent people who will actually just, they can use them only for the little bit of work that they need, a couple hours a week, and that way they'll make sure that they're not unwittingly serving a money launderer.
Mike, what do you think about that?
Well, I think even what ICE just did, what John was, this order that they gave, which was unprecedented to 700 exporters.
This is the geographic targeting order that was put into place in 5 zip codes in Doral.
Correct, just in April, and that was unprecedented. But what it did is it allowed now an educational system to this is, it's interesting how an entire industry here was still kind of like the last remnants of the old frontier. They're still doing the money laundering. They're doing the black market peso exchange. And I'm not saying nobody was looking. Certainly Homeland Security and others have been on this for a long time. But it really was the last frontier of laundering here left over from the bad old days.
But geographically speaking, John, and that's what this order that your agency pushed through the Treasury Department looks at 5 of these zip codes in and around Miami International Airport and Doral. A number of them are located in Doral. Doesn't it just push that activity beyond those zip codes?
Well, what we wanted to do is we would rather expand, you know, based on need than just cover a wide area and impose an undue burden on people that, you know, that didn't need it. We want the data to take us to the next hotspot. We want to see where things are moving. We want to see if things move. We want to see how things improve. And rather than coming in and saying, okay, look, everybody in Miami has to do this without the data, we had the data for Doral. And, you know, and if we expand, we will have the data for whatever area we expand.
It's only 180 days for this geographic targeting order. October 26th will be day one of the order no longer in place. What do you anticipate to happen?
I think that the data that we're getting now should be enough for us to expand to another area if we want to, or to extend.
Expand or extend?
Yeah.
Perhaps both.
Perhaps both. You know, again, this is the way the data is looking now. And again, it's something that we as a law enforcement agency request, and FinCEN is the agency that ultimately gives us the yay or nay.
The Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, part of the U.S. Treasury Department. That's Assistant Special Agent in Charge at Homeland Security Investigations of U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, John Toban. He's responsible for the financial crimes and money laundering investigations here in South Florida. John, thanks for your time here today on the Sunshine Economy. Ken Rejack also along with us. Ken spent 19 months in prison for laundering tens of millions of dollars in the 1980s. He now consults with banks and law enforcement on money laundering. Ken, thanks again for your experience as well.
Thank you.
And Mike Sala is an investigative reporter with the Miami Herald behind the series License to Launder, Cash Cops, and Cartels. Mike, always a pleasure. Thanks so much. I want to thank Wanda Miles, our technical producer on the Sunshine Economy, Kenny Malone, our reporter. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening.